Okay, so having had a few days away, the chapter on sudden penetration in practices and perspectives, I think I introduced the sutta already, but it wouldn't hurt to reread it because it's introduced the aspect of foundation or fundamental of practice coming down to letting go, relinquishment, releasing. Well, I'll just start here. What is to be let go of? The Buddha points to four basic types of clinging, upadana. And upadana is both clinging, attachment,
sustenance.
Yeah, thank you. So that is what sustains our being and becoming and suffering. Buddha points to four basic types of clinging that lead to entanglement and suffering. When we are able to relinquish these forms of clinging and the ignorance on which they are based, the heart has the opportunity to experience freedom. This is from Majjhima 11, which is the Chula Sihanada Sutta, the shorter discourse on the lion's roar. Because when ignorance is abandoned and true knowledge has arisen in a bhikkhu, then with the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, he no longer clings to sensual pleasures, kama upadana, no longer clings to views, ditta upadana, no longer clings to rules and observances, sila bhakti upadana, no longer clings to a doctrine of self, attavada upadana. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. So I think it's important to recognize how immediate the result of not clinging actually is. When he does not cling, he's not agitated. Not being agitated, and personally attains nibbana, realizing the ending of suffering. So it can be extremely direct and sudden. And I thought to read that whole sutta just because it's a good sutta. The shorter discourse on the lion's roar. When the Buddha gives a lion's roar, it's not for nothing. He is making an emphatic declaration about his teachings and the possibilities that the teaching holds out to us. And so this is one of his lion's roars. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, only here is there a recluse. Only here a second recluse. Only here a third recluse. Only here a fourth recluse. The doctrines of others are devoid of recluses. That is how you should rightly roar your lion's roar. So when the Buddha says, only here is a recluse, only here a second, a third, a fourth recluse, what he's referring to is Sotapanna, Sakadagami, Anagami, Arahant, the four stages of awakening that the Buddha laid out and pointed to as a culmination of the Buddha's teaching. It is possible, bhikkhus, that wanderers of other sects might ask, but on the strength of what argument or with the support of what authority do the Venerable Ones say thus? Wanderers of other sects who ask thus may be answered in this way. Friends, four things have been declared to us by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. On seeing these in ourselves, we say thus, only here is there a recluse, only here a second recluse, only here a third recluse, only here a fourth recluse. The doctrines of others are devoid of recluses. What are the four? We have confidence in the teacher, we have confidence in the Dhamma, we have fulfilled the precepts, and our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, whether they are laymen or those gone forth. These are the four things declared to us by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, on seeing which in ourselves we say as we do. It is possible, bhikkhus, that wanderers of other sects might say thus, Friends, we too have confidence in the teacher, that is, in our teacher. We too have confidence in the Dhamma, that is, in our Dhamma. We too have fulfilled the precepts, that is, our precepts. And our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, whether they are laymen or those gone forth. What is the distinction here? Friends, what is the variance? What is the difference between you and us? Wanderers of other sects who ask thus may be answered in this way. How then, friends, is the goal one or many? Answering rightly, the wanderers of other sects would answer thus, Friends, the goal is one, not many. But, friends, is that goal for one affected by lust or free from lust? Answering rightly, the wanderers of other sects would answer thus, Friends, that goal is for one free from lust, not for one affected by lust. But, friends, is that goal for one affected by hate or free from hate? Answering rightly, they would answer, Friends, that goal is for one free from hate, not for one affected by hate. But, friends, is that goal for one affected by delusion or free from delusion? Answering rightly, they would answer, Friends, that goal is for one free from delusion, not for one affected by delusion. But, friends, is that goal for one affected by craving or free from craving? Answering rightly, they would answer, Friends, that goal is for one free from craving, not for one affected by craving. But friends, is that goal for one affected by clinging or free from clinging? Answering rightly, they would answer, Friends, that goal is for one free from clinging, not for one affected by clinging. But friends, is that goal for one who has vision or for one without vision? Answering rightly, they would answer, Friends, that goal is for one with vision, not for one without vision. But friends, is that goal for one who favors and opposes, or for one who does not favor and oppose? Answering rightly, they would answer, Friends, that goal is for one who does not favor and oppose, not for one who favors and opposes. But friends, is that goal for one who delights in and enjoys proliferation, or for one who does not delight in and enjoy proliferation? Answering rightly, they would answer, Friends, that goal is for one who does not delight in and enjoy proliferation, not for one who delights in and enjoys proliferation. So the Buddha's laying out the kind of the basic parameters or content of what constitutes the goal. Because there are these two views, the view of being and the view of non-being, any recluses or Brahmins who rely on the view of being, adopt the view of being, accept the view of being, are opposed to the view of non-being. Any recluses or Brahmins who rely on the view of non-being, adopt the view of non-being, accept the view of non-being, are opposed to the view of being. So yeah, it's just this bhava-ditti and vipava-ditti. So in the same as when the Buddha in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha saying the bhava-tanha, vipava-tanha, that desire for being and desire for non-being. So holding the view. Any recluses or Brahmins who do not understand as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of these two views, are affected by lust, affected by hate, affected by delusion, affected by craving, affected by clinging, without vision, given to favoring and opposing, and they delight in and enjoy proliferation. They are not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. They are not freed from suffering, I say. So the Buddha is making a very clear statement on that sense of the that holding the view and being steeped in the view of being and non-being, or becoming or non-becoming, is necessarily going to be bound up and affected by delusion, craving, and so on, through the proliferation. Any recluses or Brahmins who understand as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of these two views, are without lust, without hate, without delusion, without craving, without clinging, with vision, not given to favoring and opposing, and they do not delight in and enjoy proliferation. They are freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. They are freed from suffering, I say. Because there are these four kinds of clinging. What for? Clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. Though certain recluses and Brahmins claim to propound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, they do not completely describe the full understanding of all kinds of clinging. They describe the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures, without describing the full understanding of clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to doctrines of self. Why is that? Those good recluses and Brahmins do not understand these three instances of clinging as they actually are. Therefore, though they claim to propound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, they describe only the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures, without describing the full understanding of clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. And this be religious doctrines and spiritual teachings that do encourage and clearly lay out a path out of sensuality and clinging to sensuality, but then there's still that attachment to views, attachment to the rules and observances. When we say rules and observances, it's like assuming that we have to do certain practices or we have to keep certain rules in order to experience spiritual awakening or freedom or purity. So that purity is found through the holding to certain disciplines and certain practices. Though certain recluses and Brahmins claim to propound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, they describe the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures and clinging to views, without describing the full understanding of clinging to rules and observances and clinging to a doctrine of self. Why is that? They do not understand two instances. Therefore, they describe only the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures and clinging to views, without describing the full understanding of clinging to rules and observances and clinging to a doctrine of self. It is interesting that the Buddha does kind of give a hierarchy of refinement of clinging, or maybe not so much refinement as what's the first go-to option for clinging. This sensual pleasure, the most obvious, next most obvious is to views, then to the next two. So I think it's interesting anyway. Though certain recluses and Brahmins claim to propound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, they describe the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, and clinging to rules and observances, without describing the full understanding of clinging to a doctrine of self. They do not understand one instance. Therefore, they describe only the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, and clinging to rules and observances, without describing the full understanding of clinging to a doctrine of self. So, there's a footnote on that. Say, this passage clearly states that the critical factor differentiating the Buddha's teaching from all other religious and philosophical creeds is its, quote, full understanding of clinging to a doctrine of self, unquote. This means, in effect, that the Buddha is able to show how to overcome all views of self by developing penetration of the truth of non-self. Because in such a Dhamma and discipline as that, it is plain that confidence in the teacher is not rightly directed, that confidence in the Dhamma is not rightly directed, that fulfilling of the precepts is not rightly directed, and that the affection among companions in the Dhamma is not rightly directed. Why is that? Because that is how it is when the Dhamma in discipline is poorly proclaimed and poorly expounded, unemancipating, unconducive to peace, expounded by one who is not fully enlightened. Because when a Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, claims to propound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, he completely describes the full understanding of all kinds of clinging. He describes the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. Because in such a Dhamma and discipline as that, it is plain that confidence in the teacher is rightly directed, that confidence in the Dhamma is rightly directed, that fulfillment of the precepts is rightly directed, and that affection among companions in the Dhamma is rightly directed. Why is that? Because that is how it is when the Dhamma in discipline is well proclaimed and well expounded, emancipating, conducive to peace, expounded by one who is fully enlightened. Now these four kinds of clinging have what as their source, what as their origin, from what are they born and produced? These four kinds of clinging have craving as their source, craving as their origin, they are born and produced from craving. Craving has what as its source? Craving has feeling as its source. Feeling has what as its source? Feeling has contact as its source. Contact has what as its source? Contact has the sixfold base as its source. The sixfold base has what as its source? Has mentality and materiality as its source. Mentality, materiality has what as its source? Mentality, materiality has consciousness as its source. Consciousness has what as its source? Consciousness has formations as its source. Formations have what as their source? Formations have ignorance as their source, ignorance as their origin. They are born and produced from ignorance. Bhikkhus, when ignorance is abandoned and true knowledge has arisen in a bhikkhu, then with the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, he no longer clings to sensual pleasures. He no longer clings to views, he no longer clings to rules and observances, no longer clings to a doctrine of self. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains Nibbana. He understands. Birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, one of the things that this comes up in the suttas many, many places, and the Buddha pointing to the law of conditionality, and sometimes it's a 12-fold link of dependent origination. Sometimes it's just shorter, like this is pretty long, but it's a bit shorter, starting from clinging and then working backwards. Sometimes it's just a snippet of the condition process. And sometimes it's just to the iddha-paccayata, the kind of fundamentals of the conditioning process. But it's something that is important in the Buddha's teaching, in that all things arise from a cause, with this and this as a condition, this arises. With the absence of this and this, then that ceases, and there's this whole conditioning process, which we can understand and utilize for our benefit in terms of freeing the heart from suffering. Any questions, comments on this sutta? Yeah.
Just go back to what you were saying about the four types of clinging.
Yes.
And how sensual desire is pretty much more of an obvious or clear one to go to. What's interesting is in terms of the different stages of realization, it's not the first thing to go. It's things like, you know, rites of rituals, which is the fetter. So can you explain a bit about why the first three fetters, which maybe not quite as obvious as sensual desire, why they...
Well, I think one of the things, sensual desire is just so deeply rooted, and then it has so many degrees of refinement. So that certainly, like the stream enterer, sensual desire and ill will, those are going to drop away to a certain degree. And then the distinguishing feature of a Sakadagami is the attenuation of sensual desire and ill will. But then it's really not completely eradicated until Anagami. But it's one of the Buddha said, it's like sensual desire has not such bad results, but it's really hard to free the mind from. Whereas, say, like ill will and anger has absolutely atrocious results, but it's much easier to free the mind from. Of course, ignorance is both. Both hard to get rid of and it's got terrible results. But that sense of the Sakkaya Ditti is, yeah, it's just like a relying on a view, and that view of identity, this is me, this is what I am. You can't really start to unravel the rest until you disentangled that one. That's your doorway into the falling away of, you know, attachment to views more broadly, attachment to precept and practice. One sees the danger, but it's just really hard to relinquish that seeking of, it's that seeking of comfort, seeking of pleasure, seeking of what? I just want to feel good. I don't want to do this tough practice. Even when you see the benefit of it, but it's layered and it gets more and more refined. So it takes time. Yeah.
With regards to the view,
yes.
Can you give a practical antidote in terms of how you can relinquish the attachment to view?
To me, what I've always done is just pay attention to how uncomfortable it is to hold a view, because oftentimes it separates one from others. I'm better than them, they're better than me, the view, the world shouldn't be like this, this is really how the world should be, other people should be. Those are all views. And as long as you keep holding to that view, then we keep suffering. Suffering's the biggest clue and the biggest catalyst for relinquishing and letting go. Because it's not that you don't have any view or perspective, but it's that one doesn't hold to it and one is not willing to create suffering out of taking a particular having.
What's one practical way to relinquish this, like, quickly?
What practical way is just Lumpa Cha, just look directly at the mind, liar. It's really pointing, because the mind is lying to us all the time, especially with views, in terms of, okay, you know, who's right, who's wrong, who's good, who's bad, who should be like this, who should be like that, who shouldn't be, you know? And it just goes on and on. You have to really pin it down. Liars, stop that. Okay, so what I've done is then, of course, go through these four kinds of clinging and find scriptural examples of the Buddha teaching about these various four kinds of clinging. The first type is clinging to sensual desires. And this is from Sangyutta 35, Sutta 131. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Bhagas at Sung Sumaragira in the Besakala Grove, the deer park. Then the householder Nakulapita approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, stood by one side and said to him, "Venerable Sir, what is the cause and reason why some beings here do not attain Nibbana in this very life? And what is the cause and reason why some beings here attain Nibbana in this very life?" There are, Nakulapita, forms cognizable by the eye that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tantalizing. If a bhikkhu seeks delight in them, welcomes them, remains holding to them, his consciousness becomes dependent upon them and clings to them. A bhikkhu with clinging does not attain Nibbana. There are sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, mental phenomena cognizable by the mind that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tantalizing. If a bhikkhu seeks delight in them, welcomes them, and remains holding to them, his consciousness becomes dependent upon them and clings to them. A bhikkhu with clinging does not attain Nibbana. This is the cause and reason, Nakulapita, why some beings here do not attain Nibbana in this very life. There are, Nakulapita, forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, mental phenomena cognizable by the mind that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tantalizing. If a bhikkhu does not seek delight in them, does not welcome them, and does not remain holding to them, his consciousness does not become dependent upon them or cling to them. A bhikkhu without clinging attains Nibbana. This is the cause and reason, Nakulapita, why some beings here attain Nibbana in this very life. So that's a very powerful statement or sutta, very direct. It's a very direct equation and worthy of taking note of. In the island, I just gave one example of clinging to sensual desire, just because it is, you know, it's pretty obvious. Actually, I don't know. There's lots of suttas that are really good, but I thought I would read, to me, one of the most powerful suttas that the Buddha gave, powerful in the sense of imagery and his uncompromising stance. Majjhima 75, the Magandhya Sutta. It's a perennial favorite amongst mendicants. And I'll read the whole sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasadamma, on a spread of grass in the fire chamber of a Brahmin belonging to the Bharadvaja clan. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kamasadamma for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Kamasadamma and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went to a certain grove for the day's abiding. Having entered the grove, he sat down at the root of a tree for the day's abiding. Then the wanderer Magandhya, while walking and wandering for exercise, went to the fire chamber of the Brahmin belonging to the Bharadvaja clan. There he saw a spread of grass prepared and asked the Brahmin, "For whom has this spread of grass been prepared in Master Bharadvaja's fire chamber? It seems like it might be a recluse's bed." "Master Magandhya, there is the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from a Sakyan clan Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. That Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. This bed has been prepared for that Master Gotama. So there's no mention of when this is in the chronology of the Buddha's life, but it's probably reasonably early in that Ananda is not with him. He's probably still young enough that he wants to get away and be on his own from time to time. And there's times when, you know, there was a sutta that I read a while ago when Meghiya was his attendant. That was before Ananda would have been his regular attendant. And he's well known already. There's the good report has been spread about. Mm. Indeed, Master Bharadvaja, it is an ill sight when we see the bed of that destroyer of growth, Master Gotama. So Magandhya does not like the Buddha. Destroyer of growth is Buddha Huno. That's wonderful, kind of onomatopoeic. Nyanamoli's rendition of, it's a cryptic expression. Nyanamoli translated as a wrecker of being. He's a destroyer of growth. So it's like a nihilist. But it's also like a nihilist that is really kind of sour. Be careful what you say, Magandhya. Be careful what you say. Many learned nobles, learned Brahmins, learned householders, and learned recluses have full confidence in Master Gotama and have been disciplined by him in the noble true way, in the Dhamma that is wholesome. Master Bharadvaja, even if we saw that Master Gotama face to face, we would tell him to his face, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that has come down in our discourse. If Master Magandhya has no objection, may I tell this to Master Gotama? Let Master Bharadvaja be at ease. Tell him just what I have said. Meanwhile, with the divine ear, which is purified and surpasses the human, the Blessed One heard this conversation between the Brahmin of the Bharadvaja clan and the wanderer Magandhya. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation, went to the Brahmin's fire chamber, and sat down on the spread of grass made ready. Then the Brahmin of the Bharadvaja clan went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side. The Blessed One asked him, Bharadvaja, did you have any conversation with the wanderer Magandhya about this very same spread of grass? When this was said, the Brahmin, awestruck and with his hair standing on end, replied, we wanted to tell Master Gotama about that very thing, but Master Gotama has anticipated us. But this discussion between the Blessed One and the Brahmin of the Bharadvaja clan was left unfinished, for then the wanderer Magandhya, while walking and wandering for exercise, came to the Brahmin's fire chamber and went up to the Blessed One. He exchanged greetings with the Blessed One, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side. The Blessed One said to him, Magandhya, the eye delights in forms, takes delights in forms, rejoices in forms. That has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected, and restrained, and he teaches the Dhamma for its restraint. Was it with reference to this that you said, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth? It was with reference to this matter, Gotama, that I said, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. The ear delights in sounds. The nose delights in odors. The tongue delights in flavors. The body delights in tangibles. The mind delights in mind objects. Takes delight in mind objects. Rejoices in mind objects. That has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected, and restrained. And he teaches the Dhamma for its restraint. Was it with reference to this that you said, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth? It was with reference to this, Master Gotama, that I said, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. What do you think, Markandeya? Here someone may have formerly enjoyed himself with forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of forms, he might abandon craving for forms, remove fever for forms, and abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. What would you say to him, Mahagandhya? Nothing, Master Gotama. What do you think, Mahagandhya? Here someone may have formerly enjoyed himself with sounds cognizable by the ear, with odors cognizable by the nose, with flavors cognizable by the tongue, with tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of tangibles, he might abandon craving for tangibles, remove fever for tangibles, and abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. What would you say to him, Markandeya? Nothing, Master Gotama. Markandeya, formerly when I lived the home life, I enjoyed myself, provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, with forms cognizable by the eye, with sounds cognizable by the ear, with odors cognizable by the nose, with flavors cognizable by the tongue, with tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. I had three palaces, one for the rainy season, one for the winter, and one for the summer. I lived in the rain's palace for the 4 months of the rainy season, enjoying myself with musicians, none of whom were men, and I did not go down to the lower palace. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of sensual pleasures, I abandoned craving for sensual pleasures. I remove fever for sensual pleasures, and I abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with fever for sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Why is that? Because there is, Magandhya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. So the Buddha is pointing to the fruits of arahantship. Suppose, Magandhya, a householder or householder's son was rich, with great wealth and property, and being provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, he might enjoy himself with forms cognizable by the eye, with sounds cognizable by the ear, with odors cognizable by the nose, with flavors cognizable by the tongue, with tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Having conducted himself well in body, speech, and mind on the dissolution of the body after death, he might reappear in a happy destination in the heavenly world, in the retinue of the gods of the 33, and there, surrounded by a group of nymphs in the Nandana Grove, he would enjoy himself, provided and endowed with the 5 chords of divine sensual pleasure. Suppose he saw a householder or a householder's son enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the 5 chords of human sensual pleasure. What do you think, Markandeya? Would that young god, surrounded by the group of nymphs in the Nandana Grove, enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the 5 chords of divine sensual pleasure, envy the householder or the householder's son for the 5 chords of human sensual pleasure, or would he be enticed by human sensual pleasures? No, Master Gotama. Why not? Because divine sensual pleasures are more excellent and sublime than human sensual pleasures. So too, Markandeya, formerly when I lived the home life, I enjoyed myself, provided and endowed with the 5 chords of sensual pleasure, with forms cognizable by the eye, so on, with tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of sensual pleasures, I abandoned craving for sensual pleasures. I removed fever for sensual pleasures, and I abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with fever for sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Why is that? Because there is, Markandeya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. Suppose, Markandeya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine, the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then he might see another leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Markandeya? Would that man envy that leper for his burning charcoal pit or his use of medicine? No, Master Gotama. Why is that? Because when there is sickness, there is need for medicine, and when there is no sickness, there is no need for medicine. Since too, Markandeya, formerly, when I lived the home life, and so on, provided with the 5 chords of sensual pleasure and the relinquishing of them, and since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. Suppose, Markandeya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine, the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he liked. Then 2 strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Markandeya? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gotama. Why is that? because that fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. What do you think, Magandhya? Is it only now that that fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching? Or previously too, was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? Master Gotama, that fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching, and previously too, that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. For when that man was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. So too, Magandhya, in the past, sensual desires were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future, sensual pleasures will be painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now, at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. But these beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. Thus, though sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch, they acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. This is longer than I remembered. So we're almost at 7 o'clock. We'll leave what's left to read tomorrow. Any questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah.
I'm just wondering, the mind-sense gate isn't included as one of the cords of sensual pleasure.
That's correct. Classically, once you have the mind, of course there is a pleasure, but it is mind-made as opposed to just based on the senses.
Okay.
Yeah.
With Vedana, the Buddha teaches that you have pleasant Vedana, pleasurable Vedana, and unpleasant Vedana. So that doesn't seem to quite fit with what he's then saying there. It seems to me like he's saying in that, that all pleasant Vedana isn't actually pleasant, it's actually unpleasant. But that doesn't
seem well, I mean, yes. Especially if it's bound up with sensuality, because then it's unsatisfying. But of course, then there's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensation of the body, of a mundane element. And then there's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensation that is of an, say, like an unworldly nature as well. Then you can have mindfulness of breathing. It can be very pleasant. And it's not entangling. It doesn't need to be entangling. Yeah.
Just thinking also, there's that in the Chula Vidala Sutta with the changing nature of pleasant and unpleasant. When it changes, it becomes unpleasant.
But yeah, it's pleasant when you experience it. When you're separated from it, it becomes unpleasant. And there's the kind of the grief that comes from losing what was pleasant. Okay, 7 on the dot.